Okay, everyone. This is Johanna Brenner. I want to welcome you. I'm a member of Solidarity. Our education committee organized this webinar. We are incredibly excited to have such a great roster of speakers and contributors to this discussion. Of course, I guess somebody said the other day that they're so tired of using the word unprecedented. You know, this is an unprecedented election and an unprecedented year and an unprecedented time. Ooh, someone cannot hear. Are people hearing me? Can you let me know? Yeah, okay. Unprecedented year. And so as we come up to this moment, I think many of us on the left are seeing the signs of organizing on a broad front as people in the country come to terms with what could possibly be a move by the Republicans and Trump to actually disallow, or in some other way, as we called it, as we say, a kind of coup. This raises many questions, but I think for us, what we wanted to put out there was an opportunity for folks on the left to talk about the ways in which what we bring to this, how we come to it, how we're organizing around it, how we're thinking about it, and also, in some sense, what does it mean from a socialist point of view to engage in what is essentially a struggle to defend bourgeois democracy? So this is the kind of question we put to our panelists. We're really very pleased that they were able to join us, and we think we have a wonderful lineup. We have 5 panelists tonight. We're going to have everyone speak for 10 minutes. And then we're going to open it up to discussion, comments, and questions from all of you out there. And again, thank you for joining. So our lineup tonight is first Jeremy Brecker, who's a historian and author and co-founder of the Labor Network for Sustainability. He's written recently 2 articles about what we might do to stop a coup and labor's role. Kim Hunter, who's a Detroit poet, cultural and political activist, is with us tonight. He'll be speaking second. Robin Peterson of Chicago, who's co-chair of Chicago DSA. And we're very glad to have this opportunity to collaborate with DSA. Toussaint Lossier, who's a member of Left Roots. And finally, Bill Fletcher Jr., who's a talk show host, writer, activist, and trade unionist. So we're gonna open up the floor to Jeremy Brecker. And I have a little card here. It just says 3 for the use of our speakers. So don't wonder if I'm waving a card around. Okay, Jeremy. Over to you.
So thank you very much. I want to thank all of you who are here. And I'm very happy to be with you, because I think the people here and people all over the country who are having similar discussions and holding similar meetings are going to be playing a crucial role if we face what looks like not a done deal, but a very likely possibility in which Trump and his supporters do essentially what they say they've been going to do, which is to refuse to recognize if they lose the election, they will refuse to recognize that, and he will attempt to continue in office. And that will be what, as Johanna said, can aptly be called a coup. In the historical heritage of the United States, and before that of colonial America, there's another name for it. It's a very ugly name, usurpation. And what we are looking at can also be described as a usurpation of power, in which people who have no right to govern and who are basing their power on force and fraud make it impossible for people to govern themselves. Now, there's 13 points I want to make in this 10 minutes, so I'm going to go fast and just hit the key points of what I think are the most important things we need to keep in mind as we prepare for this possibility. The first is that coups have been overcome. There are two studies, and you'll find the references to them in my articles, that examine 17 coups that have met with popular resistance, 14 of which were either prevented or reversed. So this is not a impossible task that has no precedent. It has no precedent in this country, but all over the world there have been successful resistances and successful overcoming of coups. The reason is that coups depend on the social institutions and the people to recognize their authority and to cooperate with them. A coup is not able to succeed by seizing a government building, seizing a capital, seizing the White House, or even seizing a military base. Coups, in order to establish themselves as the recognized legitimate government, must win the support of the people and of the social institutions of a society, or they may not have the support of the people in the institutions, but they need to make see that those people and institutions do not effectively resist them. And so the key to effectively resisting a Trump coup is to refuse to recognize it, to refuse to accept it as legitimate, and to refuse to cooperate with it. Now, in all of the cases of successful resistance, at a crucial point, there are mass demonstrations and mass non-cooperation, which show that the people aren't going along with the coup. And fortunately, there has been, although time is short, over the last few weeks, there's been a significant mobilization to lay the groundwork for a rapid response in the event that Trump loses the election, but refuses to accept that and refuses to concede and step down. And there are, I believe, now about 300 or more demonstrations planned around the country the day after the election. And we'll all have them, places that are accessible to us. I suggest that people check out where they are. There's a guide and a map on the website of Protect the Results, which is the pretty much the umbrella organization for these efforts. And this is what, something we need to be prepared for. And best if you can prepare for it with a group of friends, with your organization, with your union, if you're in a union. That's the way to lay plans in advance. They can be very, very simple. Where you're going to meet, where you're going to, what you need to bring, that kind of thing. But we need to be prepared. We have had somewhere between 15 and 26 million people out on the street this summer in the Black Lives Matter protests. So we certainly have the start of a base for making that kind of response. And we need to make it if we're faced with a situation that I think we all are afraid of. Beyond that, big demonstrations are good, but we need, if the coup doesn't collapse immediately, if Trump doesn't say, well, you know, I guess I'll leave after all, we basically may need to make society unrulable by him. And the ways that that happens is not just people in the street, but also making the institutions of society what have been called omnipresent resistance organizations. So that means every PTA, every school board, every city government, and on through all of the institutions of society that are not completely committed to the idea of a Trump coup and aren't fully supportive of it, need to say, pass resolutions saying, we regard this as illegitimate. This is not the government. He is not the president of the United States. We are not going to accept it. And then they need to find ways to not cooperate with it. And of course, the most classic and potentially powerful way is a general strike. But even before we're able to move to that level, there's lots of pieces of it that we can do. There's going to be a big youth response that's already planned by groups that among them have brought out 3 or 4 million young people at one time or another, like the March for Our Lives movement for gun control, like Sunrise, and like the immigrant rights movements. And those will take the lead in some parts of this, but workers have a special role to play because we are in every institution in society, and we're in the position to reach out both to our fellow workers and to the other groups that play a role in those institutions, and basically shut them down. And where we have to where they have to function, where we need them in order to eat and have healthcare and all the other necessities of life, reopen them under the control of our communities. We need to win away troops and functionaries from the people who are leading the coup. And that's a large part a matter of persuasion. And in the coups that have been defeated, that kind of persuasion and appeal to forces that you might expect to back the coup, but to have deeper commitments to democracy have played a critical role and have often occurred when they haven't been widely expected. A critical point to my thinking is that the frame of what we need to do is not this is Democrats versus Republicans, or this is Trump versus Biden. This is about the right of the people to govern ourselves. And if we define it in those terms, we have the opportunity to appeal to a breadth of individuals and a breadth of institutions that can put together the kind of power and the breadth of movement that's going to be necessary to make it society unrulable and to make a coup, therefore, untenable. There's a group of core demands that have emerged from many institutions, and they're very close to each other. And at the core of it is the demand to count every vote and to not stop the process of the election until every vote is counted. And that, and there are a few other sort of corollaries of that. And we need to keep drawing people together and drawing people together around those core demands for the establishment or reestablishment of democracy. And finally, the great potential strength we have is to be and to be perceived as a peaceful uprising of the people. And something that's not a fringe and it's not a violent minority. These are exactly the ways that Trump is going to portray us and that Fox News is going to portray us and that those who want the coup to succeed are going to portray us. And the core way of undermining that strategy and of winning to our side the people who are undecided, whether they are in positions of power and authority or whether they're just ordinary folks who are sitting and watching and saying, well, is this a bunch of wild hoodlums and mobsters, or is this people who are actually fighting for our interests and for the interests of society and for the interests of democracy? The way that they have to be appealed to is by our painting a different picture than Trump is trying to paint of us, painting a picture of a nonviolent people making an uprising to preserve and reestablish democracy. And thanks for being here. And thanks to the great many of you who I know are going to be out in the streets if it's necessary. I think we all hope that this cup will pass from our lips, but if it doesn't, we'll be there.
Thank you. And I'm so sorry we don't have any way of saying clapping and appreciating in this Zoom environment.
We have a way, and that'll be for people to be out in the streets.
Okay, good. Thank you. Thanks so much, Jeremy Brecker. Next up is Kim Hunter.
Hello. Thanks for everybody being part of this. I'm going to talk about what I'm doing and what a bunch of people are doing beforehand, more so than what happens if. My name is Kim Hunter. I'm a member of DSA Metro Detroit, a lifelong Detroiter, by the way, and a member of the Black Brown Alliance within that chapter. I write poetry and fiction, and I earned my living in media most of my adult life. So much of this is going to be geared toward messages and ideas, but I'll start with the basics. I'm part of We Make Michigan, a fight back table. Please, you can look us up at wemakemichigan.org and find the pledge that we are using to sign people up and be ready to move into the streets as needed. The table is geographically and ideologically diverse with everyone from anarchists, Black Lives Matter activists, clergy, party functionaries, labor, social justice folks of many stripes, liberals and revolutionaries. In October 2016, I told anyone that would listen that everyone to the left of Attila the Hun needs to form a popular front, a broad coalition. That's how fascists are beat back, proto-fascists, but you know, some of them are straight up. That's how they're beat back and defeated. While we do need to call out bad actors, the focus is more on people having what they need to survive and more democratic processes that reflect the will of the people. That's what we're trying to preserve. We have to use these principles and values to reach people where they live. The fight back table of We Make Michigan is divided into four groups: research, which looks into how fascists have been beat back in the past; media and comms, that's my group; constituents working with electeds, clergy, labor leaders that aren't more directly involved; and last, and in my opinion, the most important group are the action councils, local on the ground groups all over Michigan that will be in this, taking to the street and talking and organizing folks for nonviolent action on the ground and also talking to media. We see three main phases of the operation. Phase one we're in right now, pre-election. We're obviously still organizing, gathering, and training. We have our first press conference to announce the coalition on Monday, and there are three main messages, one of which comrade here just talked about earlier: every vote must be counted. Two, the election is unlikely to be decided on election day because of the myriad ways of voting, mail-in and absentee. And three, we need to be ready to move into the streets if needed for nonviolent action. The last two messages are crucial in phase two. That's the election day and a few days after. And as hard as it might be, we need to maintain a positive victory-focused view of things. We have and need artists and cultural workers to help us do that. That's something that's often overlooked on the left, quite honestly. But we all need to have that vision, focusing on what we need, using Trump only as a pivot to focus on how to get this regime gone as a step toward protecting ourselves and creating breathing room. Breathing room and having each other's backs is going to be a reoccurring theme too. If need be, we'll be in the streets and telling the various folks charged with counting and certifying and sending electors to do your job as you've always done. We will address delays and lies and shenanigans as need be, emphasizing what we want and need over any malfeasance. All of this is obviously subject to change, and indeed, subject to change will be likely the words we're going to be living by for the next little while, especially for phase three, which begins a few days after the election, in our view. The possible machinations are myriad. What could happen with vote counting, the Republican legislature in Michigan and other places, the electors, that's all up in the air. And that doesn't even address the possible court challenges and right-wing gangs and National Guard being deployed. With regard to right-wing gangs, we have folks who watch them from a distance, but I don't know if they've been emboldened or chastened by the discovery and dismantling of the plot against the governor of our state. Of course, everybody hopes the latter. One of the reasons the action councils will be so crucial is to monitor those situations on the ground and try to help squash lies and rumors as they may arise. I was asked about the socialist perspective on all of this, and in the short term, I believe the socialist contribution is the same as everybody's. Let's be present and committed to get over this hump. There's nothing uniquely socialist about that, but is seriously demanded by the nature of the current emergency. Even if Trump leaves office, even if he joins Snowden in Moscow and inspires a TV series, racist and fascist will still feel and be empowered as never before. And we will still need a large, relentless coalition to beat them back as best we can. And yes, voting the opportunists and true believers out of office, out of the courts and the legal system will still be a major project. It is the longer term, assuming that there is one, once we've carved out space for more, than emergency action, that we'll be able to bring a more in-depth theoretical and analytical tools, I believe. We can talk about things like pointing out that most capitalists pretended to be neutral on Trump. You can't be neutral on police killings, kids in cages, the climate crisis, COVID-19, et cetera. I believe it's helpful to be clear that we're not talking about grocery store owners or even people who own gas stations without going into too much detail, but multimillionaires and billionaires, people who own the wealth. But just being anti something is never enough. So we also have to focus on the fact that labor creates all wealth and that for true justice, folks who need to work for a living also need to have power over economic activity. The same kind of power they're supposed to have over political activity. That you can only really influence political activity if you can control the wealth. The fact that what I just said is an unruly mouthful relates to my next point. The need to talk to regular folks using words everybody can understand without going into historical detail. I can tell you that the most right-leaning factions of the 1% have made this their business since about 1964. So we have a lot of catching up to do, not just because of the head start, but largely because, and right-wing lies, but because most of the folks in the United States, of course, have no idea what capitalism is, to say nothing of socialism. The rise of the DSA, Bernie, AOC, the Squad, et cetera, notwithstanding. Whatever people are thinking or saying in socialist venues needs to be translated into language that is palatable and understandable for people waiting for the bus, working in the nail salons, trying to stretch their food dollars to the end of the month while keeping the lights on. This translation is kind of sort of what I do for my day job for non-revolutionary groups engaged in essential social justice work. I provide media support which in part means I'm supposed to create messages that regular folks can understand. And sometimes I actually do that. One of the ideas I've been pushing that may be useful to hold the coalition together is that everything that was bad about the society was made worse by COVID, and we're not going back. All the moratoriums that were happening or should be happening with utility shutoffs, foreclosures, rent, mortgage payments must be enforced beyond COVID. All the income from public dollars that people should be getting, all the releases from prisons and jails must continue post-COVID. It should not have taken a pandemic to get justice, and we need justice beyond the pandemic. To close, I encourage socialists to join in. Your presence here may be hopeful, be useful, take leadership from the most affected BIPOC, queer, immigrants, women, low-income folks, formerly incarcerated. Once we get over this hump, be ready to argue for justice in a way that people can relate to. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Kim. That was so eloquent. Okay, Robin, up to you.
Thanks, Johanna, and thank you, Jeremy and Kim, for your remarks. I'm happy to be here tonight. I'm also a dual member of DSA in solidarity, and I'm seeing some things in the chat here. What would we do if there's a violent coup by Trump's mass base? And I'll be honest, I don't know what we would do in this worst case scenario. I don't actually think that's very likely that this is going to be fought out in the streets by right-wing militias. I think we're going to see some of that, but I think that's one of the less likely outcomes. That said, like, it's going to be a mess, and I think whatever the outcome, this is a really tough time for socialists. It's hard to organize in these conditions. It's just hard to live right now. And it's not good to be hunkered down in this defensive mode that we're in for the left, because what we want is to give people hope and raise their expectations. And so I have been thinking about that. I think that there actually still is a lot of hope out there right now, a lot of things to be hopeful about. We saw Bernie Sanders have massive support in 2016 and 2020, even more so. We saw tens of thousands of people in cities across the US, I think Jeremy said millions, you know, in the streets for Black lives and against racist police violence. And then we've also in the last 4 years seen the rise of this organization, the Democratic Socialists of America, with now about 70,000 members, and we're hoping to grow to 100,000 by the end of the year. In Chicago, the organization went from a few hundred members to now we're almost at 3,000. And that gives me a lot of hope. I want to talk about DSA for a few minutes. I think that this is an organization that you can't really understand unless you think of it as not just an organization, but also a social movement. And it's that because, like, the extreme rapid growth of this organization over the course of 4 years means that we say it's a big tent organization, but it's a very amorphous thing that we're very much in the process of creating and defining and developing what our politics are and what kind of an organization we're going to be. And I think that people get frustrated. We get a lot of criticism because of the fact that we're not the socialist organization anyone would necessarily choose to have if you just made one up. But this is what we have. We have an organization of about 70,000 members that's very young. It's still mostly white, although I think its brown and black membership is growing over the past 4 years. It's also probably folks with a little more education and social power than you, then it's not the poorest of the poor. And we keep kind of growing within this constituency. And I think that's one of our challenges as we try to figure out like what kind of organization is this. And I wanna also talk about, so our organization grew after Bernie ran in 2016 and then after Trump was elected. So I think we drew a huge amount of energy from Bernie's campaign, and a lot of people joined because they heard him talking about democratic socialism. And what I think part of what we're trying to do now is grow beyond just being a Bernie creature. Like, we have different politics than Bernie today. Bernie doesn't support defunding the police. DSA does. And I think that's, for me in Chicago, that's been an important process of trying to define and give political direction to what our organization is that our chapter was able to come together and launch a defund the police campaign and try to move this, the organization that we have, a little closer to the Black abolitionist movements that have been a grassroots movement in Chicago for definitely over the past 10 years and longer than that too. So those are some of the challenges we're grappling with and trying to say what we're building. And I think we're gonna keep grappling with those no matter what happens after November 3rd. But I think we have to take the view that socialism is popular. Like, most people aren't socialists. I want to go around saying that. But these programs, Bernie's platform, Medicare for all, housing people, having rent control, having green jobs, Green New Deal, these are popular policies. They're widely popular. And the fact of that, we have to keep putting that on a big platform and building support for those things, because people actually do support them. But I think we have to show that they're still possible. I think with the defund protests, we saw people pushing back against the like harsh punishment end of things, where, you know, that's what happens when you at the other end, when you can't pay your rent, when you can't find a job, and you're subject to police violence. And I think of what we're doing in DSA is connecting that to what we could have if we funded the things that people actually need instead of the police and the military. So I think that no matter what, if it's Trump, obviously, or if it's Biden, we know that our next president is not going to be giving people what they need. And the liberal order, the neoliberal order, is continuing to crumble. And I actually think we're just going to see the gloves come off even more, no matter who is elected, against everyone who's oppressed and against the left. And that's actually what we've seen in Chicago with the uprising. Our mayor, Lori Lightfoot, took a very violent stance against that. The same with COVID. It's all about punishment and the stick and the police baton. That's all they can give to people. And I think what we can do as socialists is offer something more, something better, a vision of a better world. And I think people are still really hungry for that. And that's what we must strive to do no matter what happens on November 3rd.
Robin, thank you. It's great to hear from you and look forward to continuing with you. Okay, Toussaint Lossier, are you there? Maybe thought he had a couple minutes. Oh, there he is. Okay. Before he began.
Hey, sorry about that. So my name is Toussaint Lossier, based in Western Massachusetts, and I work with Left Roots, which is a people of color-led socialist organization. It's a national organization, but a relatively small one. And part of the reason why I've really focused on working through this organization is that its core focus has been on developing the capacities of those who we would consider in the social movement left. So people like myself who have spent a fair amount of time in various different social movement organizations, community-based groups, sometimes NGO, nonprofit groups, sometimes more grassroots efforts, consider themselves on the left, but not part of the organized left. And recognize that part of the obstacle that we faced wasn't simply our direct engagement in a socialist politics, although that sometimes is an encumbrance, but really that those of us on the left lack, in many instances at this moment in time, a broader strategic framework that we're operating from. And while we might be relatively tactically proficient in terms of how we want to advance in this particular moment, that we actually have a lot of limitations in terms of how effectively we can identify a strategy that we're working from and work at carrying forward that strategy. So a lot of what Left Roots has been focused on is really ensuring that folks in our organization, but more broadly in an effort to kind of really help enrich the conversation on the left in terms of this question of strategy, that we really develop our capacities to do that in a sort of big we sense. And also try to do that in a way where it's not simply like a handful of people are good at forming strategy or sort of tasked with that responsibility, but that's really much more of a skill that we're developing across a broad swath of people. Part of what we've been focusing on more immediately, in addition to this question of strategy, is sort of thinking about how we can approach this particular moment in a relatively strategic way. And I'm kind of drawing on that, want to just highlight a couple points that I think might be useful. Just want to raise for our consideration, and I'll try to do my best to keep it short because, like many of the people on the call, I want to hear what Bill Fletcher has to say. So we'll try not to take up too much time. But one of the things that we've been very mindful of is that we face the prospects not only of a contested election and a potential coup, but really much more the fact that rather than an outright theft of the election or a toppling of a particular incoming Biden administration, one of the particular dangers that we face is not an open coup, but really much more of a manipulation of the different mechanisms of the electoral process. And part of this danger is based upon what has been sort of the Latin American experience over the past decade, half decade. And if we followed the sort of pink tide that's emerged in the early 21st century, one of the things that we've noticed is that that's been rolled back pretty significantly across Central and South America. And in many instances, that hasn't been done through the sort of old school traditional method of a military coup, or the kind of very open toppling of a government, but actually much more of a manipulation of different mechanisms of the electoral process, whether this is the impeachment of Dilma Rousseff in Brazil, whether this is the kind of constitutional court decision that provided some thread of legitimacy to the ousting of the Zelaya government in Honduras, whether it's the coup that recently took place in Bolivia, where the use of an OAS decision provided the grounds by which those in the Bolivian Congress could claim that not only was Evo Morales not democratically elected, but that he should be ousted from power before his term had fully ended. And kind of drawing on those examples, as well as some of what we've seen take place in the US over the past several elections, just a concern that we need to be mindful of the ways in which mechanisms of the electoral process might be used to create more of a soft coup, or even a version of some of what we've seen happen with recent contested elections, a la the 2000 election, presidential election, or the 2018 gubernatorial election in Florida. So that's one point. The second point around that particular sort of manipulation of the process is the way in which that is largely predicated on, or the ability to do that is predicated on, how close of a vote we're looking at. So what is the sort of margin of what some have referred to as a margin of contestation, in terms of whether it's a landslide victory in one direction or another, or whether it's a relatively close margin of victory. And particularly noting that a relatively close margin of victory makes it, if it's a sort of, in football language, a kind of game of inches, that makes it relatively easy to use different means of restricting how many ballots are counted, what's the deadline for the counting of those ballots, things of that nature, to manipulate the final outcome. So that is just one thing that we want folks to particularly be mindful of. In some of the broader discussions we've had, and I'm not going to go into it in detail, we've been paying attention to just the question of the ways in which the Trump campaign has targeted vote by mail, and the way in which that's been used as a means by which to potentially delegitimize the mechanism by which a lot of supporters of the Biden campaign have at least identified how they're going to register their vote, and really provides an opportunity for Trump to, and it's some incentive for Trump to target a particular method of voting that is likely going to be used by people who are not voting for him. And want to be mindful of what takes place, particularly in states like Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, where unlike a number of other states, the date by which those votes are counted is really later in the calendar. So Pennsylvania is the latest in terms of not starting the counting of those votes by mail until Election Day. But that dynamic also prevails in Michigan and Wisconsin, and the degree to which those votes can be undercut really creates some problems. More broadly, in terms of our action, right? Not only what we look at in terms of these potential scenarios and how we sort of factor the uncertainty of this moment into our planning. One of the other things that we want to be particularly mindful of is that the count, that sort of timeline that we're facing, is a relatively drawn out one if we look at Election Day, or even the moment that we're in right now when people are already early voting, and Inauguration Day on January 20th. And while many of us have been done a really good job of figuring out how we can mobilize on November 4th and November 7th to disrupt, register the fact that we want all the ballots to be counted and that we want to make sure that the sort of democratic process, quote unquote, is followed through on, that there's a 35-day period by which any sort of effort to fully certify the outcome of the vote is in particular states during which that can take place. And for those of us who are around when the Bush versus Gore decision was handed down by the Supreme Court, that was handed down on the 34th day of this 35-day period that states have to clarify any irregularities in their overall voting process. We face a prospect, hopefully we don't, but we do have to kind of take stock of and think about what do we do if this is not simply a process mm-hmm. that's resolved on November 4th or it takes a week, but what if continued litigation pushes this into a 2-week or 3-week process by which there's uncertainty about maybe not the vote outcome for the whole electoral map, but in key states like Pennsylvania or Michigan or what have you. And then it's not simply a matter of how do we take to the streets, but also how do we think about sustaining some of those mobilizations if need be, not in a completely pessimistic way, because we saw during the course of the summer, folks did a wonderful job of sustaining mobilization for weeks at a time, really, and finding ways to continue to make their voices heard. But in the context of a moment where the action that's being taken is not as blatantly illegitimate and blatantly illegal as what happened with the killing of George Floyd and other instances of police murder, but there's some ambiguity in terms of what we're dealing with. How do we sustain our action, and how do we win over folks who might not just be diehard Trump supporters, but also might be somewhat swayed by claims of there being some pretense of the vote having been free and fair and what have you. And how do we look to do that in a way in which if we need to escalate our actions and we need to go from simply being out in the street and demanding that every vote be counted, but actually then move from there to a position of saying, we're going to work to shut things down, right? We're going to work to prevent the sort of normal course of business from being able to be carried out, largely through strike activity, right? But also through other forms of mobilization that would work to put pressure on both folks in the Biden campaign and encourage them not to concede early, as well as put pressure on those who can help us put pressure on a Trump campaign and those in the process of making decisions, particularly as we move further into November and December, not just at the county level where votes are being counted, but at the state level where those votes have to be certified. How do we escalate in a way that is mindful of how we can both sort of sustain our level of mobilization and also potentially contend with those who are fighting with us. And then lastly, just needing to be mindful of the degree to which whatever takes place, that we're not in the position at this moment in time, just with the way the current conjuncture is laid out, where we're going to be able to immediately sort of be in the in a position of being like, say we do the best job in the world and any potential manipulation of the vote process is thwarted and people's votes are properly counted and what have you, that we're still going to be having to deal with a fairly difficult circumstances, not only in terms of COVID and the current depression, but also in terms of the significantly strong position that the right is in at this moment in time. And that really requires us to be thinking not just in terms of how we mobilize and how we sort of seek to deal with the immediate moment at hand, but how, whether it's in forums like this or when we're out in the street together, how we're advancing in a way that allows us to better coordinate amongst ourselves and better develop some degree of improved relations between our organizations and a greater degree of engagement with those who really make up the mass of poor and working class people who are being impacted by these kind of overlapping set of crises, so that we're better able to sort of deal with the next round of confrontations that face us. So it's really this question of how do we operate in a way in which we not only deal with the situation at hand, but we start to do what we can to build the kind of set of forces that better position us, whether it's in the electoral arena, whether it's on the street, whether it's in terms of our organizations collaborating with each other, that better equip us to meet the next set of challenges that we're going to face down the road. And it's really that kind of strategic eye that we're trying to be to apply to how we assess this moment and also continue to move forward. So I'll leave it there and look forward to hearing what Bill Fletcher and other folks have to say.
Thank you so much, Toussaint. I wonder if you would like to drop the link to your scenario planning into the chat. I'm sure people would appreciate seeing that. So we've lost Bill. I'm hoping to be able to get him back. I'm not sure quite what happened, but we're going to move to some of the questions that have come up. And it's been a kind of lively debate in the chat. Whoops, I made a mishap. I'd like to get some of that into the conversation. Oh, here's Bill. He got back. Great. Wow. Bill. Hello, Bill. Stephen, is he in the is he in? There he is. Great. Bill, glad you could get back on. You're up. I think he's muted. Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. I want to thank Solidarity for organizing this. So I'm going to just say a few words. One is that what Jeremy and Kim raised, I didn't hear what Toussaint raised, I'm sure it was excellent, was outstanding. I want to say a couple of things because I looked at the chat and a number of people are particularly concerned about what do we do if there is some sort of armed response. And one of Jeremy was hinting at this. In 1920, there was a coup attempt in Germany called a Kapp Putsch, K-A-P-P. Putsch is an attempted coup. And it was defeated. And what was central to defeating the Kapp Putsch was precisely what Jeremy was talking about, an entire policy of non-cooperation. It was so effective that the Putsch leaders were walking around sort of babbling to themselves because they couldn't figure out what to do because no one would cooperate with them. So, and that was in the face of an armed coup, an actual coup. What are we looking at? And I want to say a few things about what we're looking at, but also a more fundamental thing. One, we have to assume that the local police departments and DHS would side with Trump. I think it's also fair to say that the military will probably split. and in the intelligence community, believe it or not, because the military and the intelligence community has been furious at the way that they've been treated by Trump. And so very likely there would be a significant split there. But I wanted to actually, I wanted to say that just sort of to set the stage. I want to get at something else though. Why did it take us on the left so damn long to start talking about this? Now in the spring, I and a few other people were raising this in left circles and saying, you know, knock, knock, you know, like this is like dangerous and this guy's a maniac. And there was a level of denial that was, I found absolutely amazing. There were people that were saying, no, no, you can't bring that up because that's taking attention away from Black Lives Matter. Or just sort of like, well, you know, maybe. And I was trying to figure out, and then all of a sudden around September 1st, there was this great awakening. It's almost like a voice from the clouds opened up and said, there may be a coup, and people started saying, oh shit. Well, what explains that? I think fundamentally that in much of the left, we have had a wrong assessment of this election, a wrong assessment. And too many people on the left have looked at this election as a head-to-head contest between two individuals, as opposed to understanding that standing behind one of those individuals is a mass movement, a right-wing populist mass movement that has an armed wing. And it became very clear when we saw those armed demonstrations against the COVID restrictions that they weren't playing games, that was part of the armed wing of this right-wing populist movement. And so I think that unfortunately, many people looked at this election as that. And this led to also incorrect decisions, in my opinion, about what was at stake in the election and what we on the left should do. Rooted in that is a failure to appreciate race, and specifically that the right-wing populist movement in the United States is very, very grounded in racism and misogynism. And when you downplay the centrality of race in the construction of capitalism, and you don't really look at the way that race has had a strong impact on the development of a right-wing populist movement, it's easy to look at the presidential elections as the American, as American Idol, right? Like basically, which of these two characters is gonna win? As opposed to understanding the movements that are at stake. Having said that, what should we do? Well, I think a number of good things have been raised, and so I don't wanna repeat them. What I do wanna say though, in terms of labor is this. What I'm picking up is that, first of all, there has been a paralysis in most of organized labor ever since Trump was elected in 2016. And that grew in to some extent out of a really incorrect assumption leading up to the election about the premature endorsements of Clinton in the absence of debate within the unions. And when Trump won, many unions, which will go nameless, did not know how to respond. They simply didn't know how to respond because all of a sudden they started to believe that many of their members had turned on them. And that has led to a strategic paralysis within the movement about how do you respond? What do you say about Trump? And we see that from the AFL-CIO on down. Now, within the last several weeks has been a change that started to emerge. And so on the one hand, while most of organized labor is putting a great deal of attention on election turnout, there are increasing numbers of people and at the Central Labor Council level, at some of the local unions that are beginning to talk about very concrete actions. And what I would call within the rubric of stayaways. I don't want to use the term general strikes because most of us actually don't know what a general strike is except what we've read in a book. The last general strike in the United States was in 1946. But stayaways, massive responses along the lines of what Jeremy was raising, where either people are staying away from work, staying away from business, basically indicating that business as usual is unacceptable. And that discussion is starting to move within organized labor. And from what I can tell, it's actually moving even up at the top levels. There's increasing discussions about mobilization. One of the important developments is that the Working Families Party, Movement for Black Lives, and the Rising Majority initiated a united front, the front lines, and are reaching out. And so that's very, very important. The dangers that we're facing include, as I mentioned before, right-wing terrorists. And I want to suggest that there's important lessons that we can learn from the responses of different movements to repression. So I mentioned one about the Cap Putsch. The Sudanese revolution of recent, very interesting example of a largely nonviolent movement, direct action, massive mobilization, and even in the face of provocations, pretty much stayed nonviolent and brought about a major shift. I think that that's a very, very important lesson for us to look at. And I want to contrast this with the Syrian revolution. And I'm not criticizing the Syrian revolution, but they found themselves in a bind, a massive nonviolent movement that was part of the whole so-called Arab Spring, hundreds of thousands of people in the streets, the Assad regime repressed it, including through the assassination of leaders and other forms of repression. And there was an understandable desire for self-defense. That understandable desire for self-defense evolved into armed struggle, and the movement wasn't ready for it. They just simply weren't ready for it. And that led to very, very problematic results. And so it's really important that in the situation that we're in, there will be provocateurs. There will be people that will look like us, that will try to get us to do things. And then there will be the open fascists that will probably engage in some level of violence in order to provoke things. I'm not suggesting that we don't defend ourselves. What I'm saying is you don't talk about it, and that the main thing you do is the building, we need to outnumber the other side. So we need to be at the polls on election day. We need to protect the voters. We need to make sure that people can get their ballots in. We need to outnumber these fascists and their allies any place that they show up, because history has shown over and again, when we outnumber them, they crumble. When we stay back and cower, that's when we go under. I'll leave it at that because I think I ran out of time. Thank you, Jonna.
Thank you so much. So there's been a lively discussion in the chat. One of the questions, Bill, you started to address it, which was about what is labor to be doing. But Donna, you had a question about a broad united front, and everyone has kind of talked about that. Jeremy, Toussaint, and Bill just talked about it, as did Kim. So I wondered if you'd like to state your concern or question, and then maybe the panelists can respond. There she is. Stephen, can you unmute Donna? Okay. Donna, you're on. Okay. No, we can't hear you. So Why don't you see if you can, all right, let me just, Stephen or Ansar, could you read Donna's question then?
Yeah, certainly. To
it's about the broad front. I think that's the question.
Yeah, let me.
Which is a question that a number of people raised.
Yep, 1 second, just scrolling back to it.
Okay. Why don't we
farther back in the
okay, hold on 1 sec. Let's just do this one. It says, can any of the panels lay out a specific scenario by which a coup would take place? In which state do you think it would be likely, who would be involved? What would be their motives? If the idea is to risk the coup, I think we should have an idea of exactly what it's resisting. So I
saw that question and it sort of intrigued me because it seems to be asking in which state, and I don't think the state would be the Supreme Court. That's where it would be. What would happen in the states is that the state legislatures that are run by Republicans can send in electors that they want regardless of who has been voted for in their state. At least that's the way it is in Michigan. And that's one of the things the lawyers are sort of dealing with. But the deal is that it would go to the jerry-rigged Supreme Court and they would say, oh yeah, you got it. So I don't think it would be a particular state. I mean, or it'll be a number of states like Wisconsin, where they have a Republican-led legislature, or Florida or Texas. Texas is huge in that regard. Because that could possibly flip. But I mean, I don't want to go too much into level of detail, but it's going to be at the top level that it would be happening. And it would just be reinforcing subterfuge and lies and malfeasance that would be happening on the state level, particularly in Republican controlled places.
Joanna, can I just jump in?
Sure.
While I agree with what Kim raised, I think that there's other possibilities. One possibility is that there could be armed groups like that we're planning in Michigan to attack the Capitol. So there could be something like that. There could also be the deployment of DHS personnel at election sites, possibly to try to stop vote counting. So there's a number of things like that that could happen. Now, some responses will obviously be litigation, but this is why I think that numbers are really important. If we outnumber even DHS, they're not going to mess with the people. And that's what we got to keep in mind. We've got to keep outnumbering them. There's a question from someone from Britain who's getting ready to get off because it's 1 o'clock there, who asked about what kind of international support. I think what we got to understand is that we got to shut the country down if there's a coup. And so if there's people overseas that can help with that in whatever ways that are necessary, and I don't think we discussed them on an open line, that's great. You know, I think the world has to understand that this is not a time for crying and hand-wringing. It really is that things are going to have to stop.
Thank you, Bill. Jeremy, I wondered if you wanted to jump in here also in response to that question. And a number of people have raised similar questions in the chat.
Why don't I try to respond? There's a number of questions in the chat about violence, some of which are, how do we deal with armed right-wing militias and what they might do, and some of which are broader questions about whether nonviolent means of resisting a coup are viable, whether they can work, whether they aren't doing exactly what the other side would like us to do, and so on. So why don't I try to bite into those? And let's start with the second one first, the broad picture, which is a little different from the tactical on the ground questions of how do you deal with, you know, 10 people who show up with AK-47s or the equivalent. So I think that the first let me say, if anyone was seriously interested in this question, there are two very short books. One's called The Anti-Coup by Gene Sharp, and the other is, I forget what the exact title is, but a study of 15, civilian resistance to 15 coups by Stephen Zunes. The references are in my two articles and other places as well. And they basically lay out in case study after case study how it is possible for a nonviolent, unarmed movement to defeat a very wide range of military and armed bands, armed goons, and police forces, and so on, pretty concretely showing what the political dynamics of those situations are. I don't want to try to go into that in detail, partially because the situation we face, every one of these situations is unique, and the ways of dealing with our situation, while they're going to be part of the same broad picture of how people power operates, they're going to require very specific applications to what we're facing. And a number of very wise and appropriate things have been said about that tonight. As far as the, but the basic answer is, if the people who are trying to pull a coup can't give orders and have anyone obey those orders, then that's when the coups collapse. And the historical experience over and over again is that a coup, it's not possession of a military, of a building, a military base, or of guns. It's a question of whether the things that are necessary for them to rule and govern society are available to them. And if those things, those pillars of support are removed, then they're unable to rule society. That's the broad picture. In the details, or let's say in the immediate situation we're facing on the ground, where there are armed groups of right-wing white supremacists, generally speaking, in most cases, Trump followers, and where there are, you know, evidence that they have at least seriously talked about going to polling places, going to where they have showed up at demonstrations and threatened, for example, Black Lives Matter demonstrators. There's a couple of things we ought to keep in mind. One that I picked up, I wasn't really, hadn't thought of it, but that was, I picked up on a discussion like this one, where someone said, well, you know, one important part of this is to choose the activities that we do, and especially the locations of those activities, in situations that are unfavorable to this kind of violent disruption. So polling places actually are one of those places. There's not a historical tradition of right-wingers, although we've had, I mean, I was dealing here where I live in Connecticut in the late 1950s and 1960s, we had groups called the Minutemen, which laid up arsenals and came and threatened peace demonstrators. So this is not something that's never been before. Obviously, it's at a more serious level at the present for all kinds of reasons, including Trump's endorsement and reinforcement of those groups. But one piece of it is set up what you're going to do in such a way this is unfavorable to that kind of violent disruption as possible. A second thing, as Bill said, is big numbers. It's very hard, and this has been shown in the Antifa actions and the other responses to fascist mobilizations. If they're outnumbered 4, 5, 6 times, they're not very able to provoke the kind of trouble they want to provoke. Why don't I leave it there? But there's other guidance, including a lot of training that's now going on about under the title of de-escalation, which is the ability to calm down conflict situations and make them, again, difficult situations for violence to be provoked in. There's more that could be said, but I'll stop here.
Okay. We have a few minutes left, and I'd like to pose another question that came from Donna, and to Zane, I think this speaks to what you and Left Roots are trying to do, things that Bill has talked about as well and others. And that is that there's one hand, Donna is saying, it's good to have a broad movement, the very broadest movement possible, because if we're going to get that level of people out in the streets. But on the other hand, it raises the question, is such a broad movement that's focused simply on the question of defending the election, how will that movement be able to confront all of the pressing questions that are raised as, I think Robin said, the COVID, and we're not going to go back. Well, if we're not going to go back, how do we think about we have a broad coalition and a broad front, and yet we have some tasks ahead of us that we're going to very quickly have to take up. So I hope I got her question right, but she wasn't able to ask it herself. So Toussaint, you haven't had a chance to talk yet, so if you have something you'd like to add, it'd be great.
I just want to apologize. I don't know if I'm quite getting the question. So maybe if you can rephrase it, and just in terms of the balance between breadth, it sounds like having a broad front of folks as well as the need to have a focus group or something to that effect. Or?
I think you need to have a focused politics.
Okay.
You know, so you have a broad group, you're mobilized, and what you mentioned, you know, you talked about the front line, which is a really exciting development. Mm-hmm. But I had a sense that in the front line, you're also thinking about this. How do you fold in their more radical demands in some ways, the BLM demands and so forth, into this broader movement that's pushing to defend the vote and to stop Trump from...
Yeah, I guess I would say that a couple things that come to mind around that question is just first and foremost, the need to reiterate the point that Bill and a number of other folks have made, and just in terms of the need to, like, that breadth is going to be key, right? The need to be able to mobilize and draw in a mass amount of folks. And I think one of the mistakes that was made this summer is we were very much, I think, caught up in the amazing numbers of people who were pulled onto the streets, and there was really not much effort made to like keep track of some of those folks, to kind of engage them, to find a mechanism for being able to remobilize them again at some point in the future. And so I think one of the things that yeah, I think is key for us to be mindful of is just the need to have large numbers of folks out there, and that breadth is key. I think there's been a couple key organizations that have been working and have the potential to put forward just some leadership in terms of cohering some of the demands that have been put forward and also providing some degree of direction. I think the Frontline is an amazing example in terms of kind of building on the work that the Movement for Black Lives did earlier this year, as well as a lot of the on the ground electoral work that the Working Families Party has been doing and is doing right now, as well as some of the kind of broad umbrella of organizations that the Rising Majority represents is key. The one thing though that I want to highlight is I do think it's important for us to have to kind of be nimble in terms of how we're approaching this moment, because there's a point where we, if things progress, we will need to be in the sort of position of saying we're defending the vote. And then there's a point where we might need to pivot towards saying things need to be shut down, right? Because there is much more of an indication that the vote, rather than being defended and counted, is no longer being counted. And so that is the point at which we need to be in a position to move, not simply from saying count every vote, but actually stop business as usual, because what's being done now is is in violation of the democratic process. And that I think is where the points around sort of not just labor strikes, but sort of these civil strikes and efforts to sort of shut down business as usual are really key. And part of what I was trying to suggest in terms of this potential of manipulating the vote process is that if it's a question of not simply doing it outright, but using some of the levers of what are somewhat legitimate mechanisms of the electoral process, that invites greater confusion and makes it harder for some of us to discern, here's when we're going from a position of calling for the vote to be defended to here's a moment where the voting process is outright being stolen, because the theft is not maybe just in the question of like the Supreme Court, but also what, as Kim mentioned earlier, state legislatures are doing, other mechanisms of the federal government are doing, or state governments, but under some veil of legitimate contestation.
Thanks so much. So we are almost at time. Jeremy, I was just going to ask Robin, because she didn't have a chance to weigh in, if she wanted to add something here.
Yeah, I'll just add, if I didn't say it already, I think mass mobilization is the thing we need to do. And in order to do that, we have to do mass organizing. I think that actually has to be done one-on-one, with one-on-one conversations, along with just trying to get our message out with other platforms. But I think it's just like talking to people. So I agree. I think the uprising was unorganized, but I think one of my lessons from what happened this summer is we need to get organized. I think DSA is a place to do that. The organizations that make up Rising Majority are a place to do that. We heard about a lot of others on this call. So I really think organization is important in this moment, and we have to be specific about what those organizations are, who's in them, and who we need to get in them.
Okay, thank you. All right. So we're just at 6:30, and I want to say, gee, would you mind all staying on for another hour or so we can really dig in here? But I'm going to save the chat. I hope people have saved the chat. This is being recorded, so if you know of people who missed it, let them know. And I just, you know, want to thank the panelists so much for their very significant, meaningful, mindful contributions here. It's been great to have you, and I'm sure all the people, you can't see them clapping, but I'm sure out there, everyone on this call is clapping and saying thanks for being here tonight. And with that, I'll say if people would like to stay on for a minute, that's fine. Yeah, we're going to, there's room for some last words if someone would like to have some. Anybody? Okay. All right. I'm a terrible leaver. I have trouble leaving everything. So I'm having trouble saying goodbye, but I will say thank you all to the panelists. I think it was a great evening. And yeah, I hope that we can do something like this again soon as we go through what we're going to experience over the next couple weeks. So thanks again to everybody. And to our wonderful audience and the questions they raised in the chat.
Everybody go join a group. Go find somebody that's resisting and be part of it. That's
there really you go.
What we're talking about, seriously.
Okay. Ciao. Thank you.